This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. It is 10 a.m. on Wednesday, May 29th, and this is KDLL Adventure Talks. I'm Jenny Nyman, and for the next hour, I'm going to be speaking with Alaska guidebook author Lisa Maloney, who recently released her newest book, Day Hiking South Central Alaska. Lisa will do a live presentation about trails, hiking safety, gear, writing, and other topics at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, May 30th, at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. It's free for KDLL members or $5 for non-members. But today, we're talking about how Lisa got into hiking, writing, and writing guidebooks, specifically. As it turns out, none of those routes took a straight line. So, Lisa, to start with, how did you get into hiking? Were you outdoorsy as a little kid?
Well, I did not grow up. Well, I take it back. I was going to say I didn't grow up in the outdoors, but I sort of did. I was a military child, so I'm not really from anywhere in particular. When people ask if I'm from Alaska, I say it's the only place I've been for more than 2.5 years, and I've been here for 30 now, so maybe I'm getting close to a little Alaskan credibility. The station before we moved to Alaska was West Germany, and I guess if I got any kind of an introduction to outdoorsy things, it was there. They had something called Volksmarches, where people would just get together to go walking in the forest for fun. And then at the end, you would get a little pin for your hat or some sort of a participation award, a small thing that everybody got. And as a little girl, I was all about the chance to walk around in the trees. And I was all about getting the neat little doodad at the end of the day. So that's probably my first introduction. I didn't really get into hiking until I was probably around 18 here in Alaska. And I realized that there was a great big world out there that I could explore on my own.
Is your family kind of outdoorsy, however you would define that? Or was this an interest that you pursued on your own?
Oh, they're not at all outdoorsy. I am an aberration. The closest we ever got to roughing it was sleeping in a public use cabin once somewhere near the Kenai River, I think. But something about being outside has always just fascinated me. As a little girl, once we did get here to Alaska, I didn't ask to play with dolls. I said, can I go outside to the green belt near the house and play with the sticks in the mud? And my poor older brother would have to go along because I was too small to go out on my own and run away from moose, I guess. So he was always very unhappy and sort of stuck grumbling out in the woods while I very happily played in the dirt.
Along with hiking, were there other pursuits that you developed along the way? Are you a paddler? Are you a skier? Anything like that?
Sure. So I've dabbled in almost everything. Some things really suit me. I was an avid rock climber for a good while, and I've got a big dramatic story about why I stopped. But that was something that I very much loved. Something that did not suit me was snowboarding. I tried it. I managed to give myself a concussion on the Bunny Hill at Hilltop here in Anchorage, which if you know the place, that's the babiest of the baby hills you can get. So it took me a lot of work to really catch that front edge, get some big air on the way downhill head first, and then sort of tuck and roll. And I did a full layout. The people who were watching said it was really impressive. And I managed to happily come down flat on my back, which unfortunately included the back of my head. But it was much better than pile driving myself head first on the Bunny Hill, which is what I almost did. So I've dabbled in lake kayaking and sea kayaking and things like that. Those also suit me pretty well, except for the fact that I get panic attacks when I float. Sinking doesn't bother me. Standing in water doesn't bother me, but the physical sensation of floating will make me black out and start climbing the nearest person to me like a tree, basically. So it always strikes me as funny that people see that you I guess I can say I'm an expert at hiking. You know, if I can't say it by now, when can I? But they see
that. You did kind of write the book on it, as they say.
A couple of them, actually. But people see that and they think, oh, she's an impervious hard body. And, you know, that's not really the case. There are some things I'm good at. There are some things I'm not so good at, but I enjoy trying. And then there are other things I just flail at horribly.
I like that approach, though, that maybe focuses your energy instead of thinking, oh, well, maybe I could be a snowboarder. You know, I should really try and paddle more. No, you definitively have proven, nope, snowboarding out. Done. Not going to spend any more time on that one.
That's
check
true,
that off the list.
It's within the realm of possibility. The reason that I had that issue and that I got so badly hurt was actually because somebody had told me that I did not need to wear snowboarding boots.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
caveat.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. And this was a good friend of mine, too. She also told me that I should go up to the top of the mountain with her because it was no big deal. So the lesson for the day, for me at least, was even if your friends love you, they don't always know what they're talking about. And you should probably just go take a lesson if things end badly. So I might try that again someday. And, you know, I love very low-key mountain biking, but because of the whole snowboarding thing, I sort of wrote off all the very steep and fast downhill pursuits. So I'm afraid that I will never be one of those wonderful people bombing down the slopes at Alyeska. But I am an avid watcher of them. Although I will say my past in rock climbing in particular has actually helped me with hiking quite a bit because I'm not afraid of heights. I should probably knock on wood when I say that. I'm sure it could happen someday. And exposure generally doesn't bother me. Exposure meaning not the illegal pants down short, but the it having a steep fall underneath your feet, like right. If you're walking on a knife edge ridge. And it's interesting because I find that's a term that people aren't always familiar with. But it is something that you're bound to encounter if you hike much up here just because, oh, hey, a lot of our terrain is pretty steep.
Yeah, and in the Chugach, pretty steep, and those rocks aren't always super stable either. So good thing to be aware of.
Right. They're very much not super stable. I have seen huge chunks fall down along the highway, and it's not just in the Chugach. You know, it is mostly north of the Kenai, although you'll sure find plenty of rocky bluffs down there. But going even further north into Hatcher Pass, up around the valley area, I remember camping up there once years ago, and I want to be dramatic and say half a mountain fell down. It wasn't actually that much, but there was a massive landslide on one of the granite climbing routes up there. So a lot of the South Central Alaska shale gets bad press for a very good reason, because it's really brittle and it tends to crack and it just comes apart under your hands or under your feet. But up there, it was granite. And when daylight came, we all sort of stumbled out of our tents going, holy smokes, what was that fell down? And we could see the gigantic just scar where a lot of the rock had come down. So even with granite, there's not a complete guarantee.
Yeah, that's a good thing to be aware of. You definitely know Chugach crud, as it's called, when you're on it, and it doesn't take a whole mountain to come down to terrify you if it just happens to be the rock under your foot or under your hand. But yeah, seeing granite come down in that volume, that would be a good wake-up call, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we couldn't see it since it was dark, but we heard it. And I can't even think of how to describe the sound. It was very impressive, let's put it that way.
And that is Lisa Maloney, author of Day Hiking South Central Alaska. You're listening to KDLL Adventure Talks on the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jenny Nyman, and Lisa will be giving a live presentation about hiking and trails and all kinds of other things at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, May 30th, at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. So before we get too far away from this, you did mention a dramatic reason for why you don't rock climb anymore either. So I have to bite. What exactly happened to end your rock climbing?
Okay, so at first, let me preface this by saying I'm fairly certain that I'm not crazy. And if I am, I'm hopefully the good kind of crazy. And I'm saying that because what happened is I had a dream where I was climbing with people I didn't know, and something horrible happened. And I can't remember the specifics of what happened in the dream, except that afterward, still in the dream, I was thinking to myself, man, if I had that to do over again, I would never go climbing today. I so wish I had not climbed today. And that's no big deal, right? People have nightmares or bad dreams all the time. But what stopped me from climbing is because a couple of years after that, I was climbing in Utah with some friends, and one of the friends had had to duck out, but not before inviting some of his friends that we didn't know along. And so these other friends that were strangers to us at the time came along as well. And we were all camping out near the climbing sites. And in the morning, we were sitting at the picnic table, you know, eating breakfast, chatting, making plans for the day, as you do. And I happened to look left down the table, and then I looked right down the table. And silently inside my head, I went, oh no, this is exactly how that dream started. So in the dream, I hadn't known the people, and I had actually woken up and I had gone, oh, thank goodness, that'll never actually happen, because I'm super careful and I do not climb with strangers. I just would never do it. But because of the fellow who'd had to duck out, there were those strangers. They were exactly the people. Everybody was in the same configuration at the exact same place that I had seen in my dream doing the exact same thing. And so that, call it deja vu or whatever you will, that made me sit up and take notice. And I remembered how much I regretted having climbed that day in the dream. So I turned to the guy who I was supposed to climb with that day. And, you know, I was thinking, oh, he's going to tell me I'm insane. This is going to end badly, but I have to say something. And I said, look, let me take you aside and tell you about this dream I had. And I don't think that I should climb today. And in the dream, I think it was something that had happened to him. I was actually okay in the dream. It was something that had happened to somebody else. I think the rope got cut or it broke or something catastrophic like that. And so I told him I didn't think that he should necessarily climb either. And he's grown up. He's going to do what he wants. And I feel very fortunate. He's a very good friend. He listened to what I said. He didn't even roll his eyes once. And he just thought about it for a second and said, you know, I think you're right. I'm going to go for a hike today instead. So several of us actually went hiking that day instead. Nothing horrible happened. And then we went back to climbing just like usual at the end of that. But after that, I started having recurring dreams about issues with my own rope. And finally, I just got to the point, because I don't have recurring dreams, but these would keep popping up. I'd be flaking the rope out, which includes running it through your hands to feel for any soft spots, because it's the inside of the rope that you can't see that gives it the strength. And I'd be running it through my hands, and in the dream, I would find a soft spot that you couldn't see with your eyes, but I could feel with my hands, that told me that if I climbed on that rope, something horrible would happen. And you'd think I would just retire the dang rope, right? but after long enough of this, and then I had, I happened to mention that to my normal climbing partner here in town, and she looked at me kind of funny, and she said, well, I wasn't going to tell you about this, but I also had a dream that we went climbing at the place we were heading up to later that day. It was called the Wookiee Wall. And she said, and I dreamt that you had a ground fall and that your climbing partner came running around the corner and said that we needed to go put you back together. And so you just combine all of those things together. And I look at it and I go, all right, somebody or something is trying to send me a message. Maybe it's my subconscious. Maybe, you know, who knows what it is, whatever you want to call it. When you get that many flashing red flags in front of you, as much as I loved climbing, and I really did, I just stopped. Hmm. I said, okay, there's a message in here. I don't think I want to know what the message actually is. I'm going to duck out before it gets delivered.
Yeah, it's good to know your comfort level and to listen to that, even if, you know, weather reports are one thing and trail reports are another thing too. But if you're just not feeling it, why force yourself to do something you're not going to be comfortable doing?
Sure. And that absolutely applies to hiking too, and to any outdoor pursuit, right? If you are looking at paddling down a river and you go, man, I have a bad feeling about this, don't go. or evaluate and figure out what the issue might be and decide if it is a type of risk that you are willing to accept or not. I mean, I'm probably, I hope I'm not making going outside sound like a really dangerous thing. But we do live in Alaska, and the fact that it's an uncontrolled environment is part of what makes it exciting. But it also means that, you know, you should just be aware of possibilities and prepared for them when you go out there, so that on the very slim, slim chance something does happen, then you're equipped to deal with it.
Right.
Sorry, that's my soapbox that I hop onto at every opportunity.
That is a good one. That's always good to keep in mind. So we talked a little bit about how you got interested in the outdoors and your various activities that you've done out there. So you obviously have taken the additional step of then writing about these things. How did you get into writing? Caveat, I understand that you did not get a degree in anything even related to writing.
No, so I got into writing by studying math.
Okay, not a straight line trajectory. As a math person, I'm sure would know better than I. There's probably a term for a line that deviates that sharply. But how did that progression happen?
I think it's called a zigzag.
Okay, So you're the expert. I'll go with that.
Okay. So in all fairness, I should rewind a little bit. And my mother just recently moved out of town. And as she was packing things up, she told me that she had found my first book. And I said, excuse me, what? And she had this little handwritten cookbook, and you can't see it, but I'm making air quotes when I say that, that I had made for her on Mother's Day when I was 6 years old. And, it, you know, my concept of cooking and writing and such, it was a little fuzzy back then, but it had a cover, it had a table of contents, and then it had little recipes in it, like if you needed to make peas with cream sauce, which apparently was a thing for me back then, you got some cream sauce and then you got a can of peas and then you counted out 100 peas, not 99, not 101, there had to be 100 of those little suckers in there. And then you put them in the cream sauce. Bam, done. Move on to the next recipe. So interestingly enough, I looked at that little book and I looked at her and I said, so how could you see this and not realize that I was going to be a writer one day? And she sort of shrugged and went, yeah, I thought the same thing. How about that? That is sort of the path that I was naturally on, not as an occupation, but just as a state of being. I don't know why, but just like as a little girl, I wanted to go out and play in the dirt and the mud and the sticks, even though I hadn't had that much of an example except for the Volksmarches in Germany. And in all fairness, I also have family that farms down in New Mexico, so we would visit down there as a little girl, and I would get to run around in the fields and play with extra special mud. So that probably helped too. But just for the same reason, I don't know why, I don't think anybody does, but I had to read obsessively as a child. My recollection, I'm sure there's more to it, but my recollection of learning to read is that there was this book that Mom would read to me. I think it had something to do with chocolate chip cookies. I don't know what the whole theme was, but there were cookies involved. And I remember that she would read to me and I would look at the letters and I'd be like, dang it, I know the information is in there. How do I get it out? And one day I must have memorized the book or something. And I remember sitting down with it and going, okay, that's the word that's here. So those letters make that word. And then on to the next word. Okay, that's this word. So that's my only real recollection. It was like, I know there's information in there and I'm going to get it out somehow. And from there, I just never stopped. And I wrote, I both read and wrote obsessively as a child. I would read books walking down the street. My mother used to be terrified for me because I'd walk to school and I didn't want to lose that opportunity to read. So I would read while I walked to school and I would run into light poles and things like that because I had my nose buried in the book. And again, looking back at that, I go, how did I not realize that I was going to be a writer? But I was a normal kid. The normal is questionable, but I was a kid. So I also wanted to be a circus acrobat and, a cowgirl and a cowboy and a model and a teacher and a firefighter. I mean, if it was an interesting thing, probably the last thing I'd read about, I wanted to be that thing. But all the time I was still writing fiction, believe it or not, which is odd because I obviously have become a nonfiction writer. It's how I make my living now. Back then, I wanted to write novels. And when somebody had the temerity to suggest to me that maybe I should look into nonfiction because it's easier to make your living that way, I actually laughed at them. I said, "You're crazy. Why would I want to do that? That's boring." Well, it turns out it's anything but boring. And that obsessive habit of reading and writing is what actually made me into a writer, because I was learning as a consumer and as a practitioner, what worked and what didn't. So there was a lot of trial and error involved. But if you think about it, if you go through an English degree or a journalism degree or anything like that, you're also doing a lot of trial and error and figuring out what works and what doesn't with the help of someone to guide you. In my case, it just happened to be largely self-taught. And then the math degree comes in because as I was getting close to finishing it, people would ask me, they'd say, "What are you going to do with your degree? Are you going to go into teaching? Are you going to go into grad school? What's next?" And I surprised myself as much as I surprised them when I said, "Well, I'm going to throw it in the closet and I'm going to go be a writer." And they would sort of look at me and go, "Huh?" And in my head, I was also going, "Huh? Where did that come from?" But people kept asking, and I kept saying the same thing. It just sort of popped out. I didn't even think about it. Just boom, there it was. And finally, after hearing myself say that, I realized, you know, I'd better put up or shut up. If I'm going to keep saying this, I'd better actually try it. And so I did. I unwittingly wrote what was maybe a fairly decent pitch to one of the local newspapers up here. I basically explained that they didn't have a hiking column, but they should because it's something that a lot of people do up here and that people need more information about, and that I should write it for them because I was already hiking quite a lot by this point. So I already had a good base of knowledge and I was already out there gathering more knowledge and information. And lucky me, they gave me a test shot at it, thinking that maybe we would do a column every 2 weeks. And then the next information I got from them was, "Great, when's your next column coming in? We're going to do it every week."
Nice. And that was in 2005 that you started doing that? Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was the middle of summer in 2005. And the little paper was the Anchorage Press up here, which is a little weekly. So kind of the, one of the pieces of advice that I always give to people who are looking to get into writing is to definitely reach out to local publications, because if you have local knowledge that is a good fit, that's a great place to get your toe in the door, learn how the process works, and also get published clips. And once you have your first clip, it's like stepping onto the first rung of a ladder. It's now much easier to get up to the second rung. So it's easier to get your next clip once you can say, "Hey, I was published here." And then you just keep building from there.
That ladder for you has gone to some pretty cool national stuff. I mean, you've been in Backpacker, let's see, Northwest, Travel and Life, Wall Street Journal, I believe. You know this list better than I do, but where other places can people find your work?
I to be honest, I have to go back and look at the list sometimes just because it's a constant stream of since I'm a full-time freelancer, I don't work as a staffer for any publication. Then my life is just a constant stream of a new project almost every day. So sometimes I'll look back at one of my old bios and say, "Wait, did I write for those people?" And I go, "Oh, yes, I did." So nowadays, you're probably more likely to find me in Northwest Travel and Life. I've been writing for them with some frequency. I had an article that I loved, and I hope readers did too, in The Writer magazine in April of this year. So a little more than a month ago, that was actually about the nuts and bolts of guidebook writing. And that's always a fun thing for me, especially coming from a non-writing background, to be able to look at that and go, "Oh, hey, how about that? I'm now telling people how to do it in a writing magazine." But the best way to find my work, I'd say, especially for outdoorsy things, would be to follow me on social media. I am at Hiking Alaska on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And I also have a website that I have big plans for. I haven't been able to build it out quite as much as I'd like to, but I'm working on it. And that is hikingalaska.net. And that's meant to be a companion to this book. And I also have another hiking guidebook that's specific to the Anchorage area. And it's very, very old. It's actually embarrassingly out of date. It's about 10 years old now. But there's a second edition of that one coming out later this summer. So it's a companion for both of them so that when trails change, I can put out updates there much faster than a publisher would be able to update the book, because it takes 6 months to a year just on the publisher's end of things to turn what I give them into a book. And then they're obviously not going to trigger that long and for them expensive process just because there's been a change to one small trail. So I'm really looking forward to using the website as an opportunity to keep people abreast of the latest developments in real time or as close as I can get.
And the guidebooks that you're mentioning, 50 hikes around Anchorage, correct? That's the Anchorage specific one?
That's the old one. We don't talk about that one very much.
Okay.
But I'll be talking about it more once the update comes out in July. I'm pretty excited because the update will have, I think, 12 brand new trails in it. And just a lot of updates. One of the things I noticed as I was working on the guidebook that I am talking a lot about right now, which is Day Hiking South Central Alaska, is there's actually a lot more going on in South Central than I realized. So, for example, I had mapped out the Saddle Trail, which is one of the awesome trails across Ketchumak Bay from Homer that you take a water taxi to get to. And as soon as I had done that, I heard from someone else, hey, they just put in new switchbacks on the Saddle Trail. And I went, oh, you're kidding me. Okay, I better go map it again. So then I went and I mapped it, and I happened to talk to one of the rangers down there, and he said, hey, look at this. We're rerouting this trail entirely to have better views of from an overlook of Gruing Glacier, which is another trail that links into that. And I think they're actually doing that work this summer. So last summer, as I was wrapping up the tail end of research for the hiking guidebook, I just sort of shook my head, and I said to myself, great, which of these trails do I put in the book? I guess I'll mention them both so that readers will understand, you know, here's why your GPS track might look a little bit different than the map, just because they're doing a lot of work on these trails.
Right. Yeah, the internet's definitely not as helpful for carrying around with you as a reference when you don't have cell service, but it sure is nice for being able to get updated information beyond a publication date.
Yeah, exactly. So books are forever in a way that the internet isn't. I guess that's debatable, but at least on the internet, you can go back and edit something or put out a little notice. But like you said, books, you can carry them around when you don't have internet access. Their batteries never run out. I have done some hikes under thick tree cover, and Whittier is especially one that comes to mind. And I've looked at my GPS track afterward, and it looks like a freaking Etch-a-Sketch. You know, it's just a bunch of zigzag lines. And we actually got maybe not quite lost on that hike, but we got to the point where I pulled out my GPS and I looked at the track thinking that it might help. And it was absolutely no help because of the tree cover. So, you know, I am biased, but I would definitely make a case for things that you can carry that won't have technological glitches when it matters. And hey, you can also start a fire with a guidebook. You cannot do that with your smartphone. You probably don't want to anyway. Oh, and one other, if I can slip it in, I also was pleasantly surprised to find myself travel writing almost by accident. So I do have a travel guidebook out there that I'm pretty proud of. It's called Moon Alaska, which is part of a series. So you can get, you know, like Moon Costa Rica and Moon Ireland and Moon Pacific Northwest. And it actually won a shiny award from the North American Travel Journalists Association, which was a big shock for me because the publisher didn't tell me that they had entered it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And when I got the email about the award, I was actually at an off-the-grid farm in Spain, puking my guts up from food poisoning. So, and you know, the nearest hospital is 8 miles away with no public transport, and my travel companion and I were just sort of I mean, I was busy puking, but in between vomiting bouts, we were both sort of going, this could be bad. How are we going to handle this? And so I missed the congratulations email when it first came through, and I didn't actually find out about it until a couple months later when I thought, man, I'd better go double check and see what else I missed when I was so sick.
Being a freelance writer then, mostly of an article here, an article there, which is a narrow topic and time commitment, and you're done and then you're on to the next thing. What possessed you to go into writing books and guidebooks in particular?
Well, that first guidebook, the one we don't talk about, but I'm going to talk about it, the 50 Hikes Around Anchorage, that was my first book deal. And I got that in, I think we signed the contract in early 2009. And then I spent that summer rehiking all the trails that I already knew about to, you know, take better pictures and try to do maps and so on. And then it came out in 2010. And I honestly cannot remember what got it into my head to, you know, turn around and chase down a book deal. But that's exactly what I did. I had been writing outdoors columns for that little paper here in Anchorage, the Anchorage Press, for at least 4 years at that point. And so I had a couple hundred columns under my belt. I figured, hey, I've already gone out and written about all these trails. Why don't I just take those columns and turn them into a guidebook? It'll be the easiest thing in the world. Well, it wasn't all that easy, but excuse me. It was definitely a good learning experience. I discovered that writing for a book audience is very different from writing for a newspaper audience. And that back then, GPSing was not quite as easy as it was now. So I spent, after I screwed up the GPS track, something awful, I GPSed about 25 trails, one on top of the other. And now I would be able to myself go into a tool like Caltopo online and just untangle that in pretty short order. But back then, that was not a possibility. And the publisher's cartographer couldn't do anything to save me. So I spent 2 weeks with all the USGS quads for the Anchorage area spread out on the floor of my tiny little apartment, crawling around on top of them with a handful of colored pens, drawing in all the maps and all the features by hand until I screwed up the electronic version. So that was a good learning experience too. I'm better at GPSing now. But all of that came about because I started chopping the idea around. I went up to different publishers and I said, hey, there are some guidebooks here, but I think that there's a niche immediately around Anchorage that hasn't been filled. And I think I'm the person to fill it because I'm already familiar with the trails. I can write. Here are several hundred clips as proof. And it took, I think, 3 or 4 tries before I found somebody that was actually interested in it, which is, I'd say, somewhere between typical or maybe even unusually fast for getting a book deal. Some people are lucky enough to get a deal the first time through, but it's incredibly common to have to go through rejection after rejection after rejection. And another thing that I like to tell people who are in writing or interested in getting into it is that rejection doesn't mean that your writing is bad. Sometimes, yes, it is a clue that there's something that you can work on there. There's always room to improve. But rejection is just a fact of the industry. So it still happens today. You know, I have established relationships with some editors where it's a lot easier to bend their ear and say, hey, here's this great idea. You should hire me to write an article about this for your magazine or your newspaper. But at the same time, it's just a fact of life. I get told no a lot. Doesn't mean I'm a bad writer. It just means that was not the exact correct combination of circumstances for that idea. So I just try again.